Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I would suggest to you that this issue about Gardasil and making it available was about saving people's lives. I sat on the side of a bed of a young lady in Texas who died with cervical cancer. It had a powerful impact on me.
That was Rick Perry, governor of Texas, presidential hopeful, talking about the 2007 executive order in his state, which had young girls required to get the HPV vaccine, human papillomavirus vaccine, associated with cervical cancer, before, that is, the virus is associated with cervical cancer, and the vaccine was going to be required before the sixth grade. It's now become a political issue, as both progressive and conservative groups have come out against mandatory inoculations. At least some progressive groups have joined the conservatives in this. We had two segments on the HPV vaccine last week, but today we continue the conversation with a look specifically at the medicine behind the inoculation, which legislators in at least 27 states have considered mandating, and which was required of women and girls applying for green cards or for citizenship in the United States in 2008 and 2009. That rule then went away. Joining me now to explain the health and science behind the HPV vaccines is Alice Park, staff writer for Time Magazine, who covers health and medicine for their Healthland blog, and she's been covering the HPV vaccine for years. Hi, Alice. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So, again, this vaccine discussion has been about cervical cancer, but it's also about sexual health and genital warts, not to mention questions now about the role of government. But let's start here with a little primer on how a vaccine against a virus can prevent cancer. How does that work, at least in theory, and how well proven is the science that it does work?
Well, it works because this is one of those instances where the virus is known to be related to the processes that are responsible for cancer. And obviously, this doesn't happen all the time, but in this case with cervical cancer, the human papillomavirus comes in hundreds of different strains. And we know that a handful of them are very commonly associated with cervical cancer. So women who have cervical cancer are more likely to be infected with this virus. And the two vaccines were developed, tested, and approved that are shown very effective in stopping infection with this virus and stopping this virus from going on to cause cancer in the cervix. These are vaccines that in earlier trials have proven, you know, up to 90% effective in preventing cancer in these women. And that's a big deal because here in the United States, about 20 million people every year are infected with HPV. And, you know, there's 6.2 million new cases each year.
And at very least, parents are needing to make the decision in many cases. Anybody who stops and thinks about it, if it's not mandated in your state, as to whether to get this vaccine for your daughters when they're 11 or 12 years old, as is recommended. So if you have a question for Time Magazine health reporter Alice Park on the medicine of this, after we've done the politics of this a few times last week, call us up right now, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or you can post your question to our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Alice, why so young?
Well, this is one of the big issues, and this is what made this vaccine so controversial. So you've got a vaccine that is effective against cervical cancer, and it also happens to be effective against genital warts, which is sexually transmitted. And you had public health experts who were looking at this vaccine and looking at the rates of infection with HPV and realizing that here is something that we can do as a public health measure to reduce the number of infections, to reduce the spread of HPV among sexually active people. A lot of parents immediately were very surprised when this vaccine that's associated with sexually transmitted diseases was recommended for girls so young. And the reason for that is really twofold. One, because, you know, sort of capturing a vaccine-targeted population is easiest when they're younger. So childhood vaccines, you know, we have that list of vaccines that we all get as children, and it's easier to get children into the doctor's office to get routine vaccinations when they're younger. Teenagers are much harder to corral and to convince to go to the doctor for something like this. Secondly, the way these vaccines work, you really want the children, the girls, to be protected before they become sexually active, before they get exposed to the virus. And in order to do that, it's a good idea to have them inoculated when they're about 11 or 12, before they really become sexually active in their teen years. So that was the reasoning behind recommending it, why the CDC and other public health experts recommended this vaccine for girls who were pre-adolescent.
Vicky in Queens is calling with the next question that I was going to ask anyway. So, Vicky, we're going to let you do it. Hi, you're on WNYC.
Hi, thanks. I'd like to know from the medical perspective why you wouldn't also vaccinate the boys who carry and spread this disease in addition to the girls who could get it.
Why not the boys? If HPV is a sexually transmitted disease and the girls got to get it from somewhere, why not mandate that everybody at 11 and 12 get it? Why let the boys off the hook?
That's a really good question. And the boys actually are not off the hook. The vaccines are approved for boys. They just haven't been recommended for boys yet. And the reasoning for that is that really public health experts were looking at this primarily as a protection against cancer. And the cancer is cervical cancer, which only girls get because only girls have cervixes. So this is the reasoning behind why the girls were targeted initially and the boys were not. But increasingly, there are more studies showing that boys should be vaccinated. And it is approved for boys. It just hasn't been recommended for them yet.
Does it last a lifetime?
Well, the idea, as with any vaccine, is that once you're inoculated, your body will produce the proper antibodies and the proper immune response that once you get exposed to the virus, your body will know what to do and be able to protect you from infection.
So that's not a definitive answer to me. I know there's been some question as to whether this wears off after a certain period of time. But you're saying if inoculation medicine, as it's supposed to work in theory, works, then it would be a lifetime immunization, and your assumption is that it is?
Yes, it is, because the way your body works is that once you've been sort of primed and trained to recognize viruses like this, your body will be able to combat the infection.
Mary and Mawa, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. Hi, I'm just wondering about the side effects in general, how long it was tested, and in particular on such a young age group.
Good question. It's considered a relatively new vaccine, right?
Yes, the first one, there's two of them on the market. The first one was approved in 2006, and the second in 2009. And those were approved after, you know, extensive testing. But once vaccines or any drug, for that matter, is approved, the testing doesn't stop. It continues. There are systems in place for both doctors and people to report any potential adverse effects, you know, even once a vaccine gets to market and millions of people are exposed to it and use it. So, the vaccines were fully tested beforehand on the target group, and they proved to be very effective in combating the infection. Very recently, a panel of experts with the Institute of Medicine was charged with really looking at questions of adverse effects, side effects, and whether vaccines were responsible for them. They did a very extensive look at all of the literature out there on a number of vaccines, 8 vaccines, including HPV. And their conclusion, after looking at all of the data that's currently available, is that there was only one concern with the HPV vaccine, and that is anaphylaxis. That's sort of a very hypersensitive allergic reaction.
Some people will be so allergic to it that they could go into anaphylactic shock, which could be fatal, potentially. Tiny percentage? Do you know the percentage?
Very small percentage. I don't have the percentage right in front of me, but you know, they also looked at a number of other neurological conditions, 13 possible adverse reactions, including autoimmune disorders like Guillain-Barré, Lou Gehrig's disease, multiple sclerosis, and they concluded that the evidence at this point was inadequate to really connect the vaccine to any of these possible adverse effects.
Still, you don't want to expose your child to even the remote possibility of anaphylaxis unless you think that the benefits are quite clear. What do you think of the work of a dissident doctor on all of this, Dr. Diane Harper? She was a lead investigator for clinical vaccine trials of Gardasil, which is the Merck product, and Cervarix, which is the other HPV vaccine, which has been approved by the FDA, and she's been quoted as saying the rate of serious adverse effects is greater than the incidence rate of cervical cancer. She also expressed concerns about the vaccines not lasting forever and that girls might need booster shots when they grow up after a period of time. But this is an interesting public health stat comparison. The rate of serious adverse effects is greater than the rate of cervical cancer among those who are not inoculated.
Well, again, see, when you read a statement like that, you really need to look at what we call the common denominator. You know, what group are you looking at when you calculate that percentage, that rate of adverse events, and what group are you group of women are you looking at when you look at the percentage of women who develop cervical cancer? And often, you know, with statistics, it gets very confusing, and it may appear as if it's not a fair comparison, but you're really comparing apples and oranges in some cases. So you have to be sure when you're reading a statement like that that you're really comparing the correct group. And the only way to do that, really, is to start with a group of girls who are 11 or 12. You inoculate half of them with the HPV vaccine. You don't inoculate the other half, and you just follow them, you know, until they become of age where cervical cancer generally starts to appear, and you compare their rates.
We just have a minute left. I want to make sure to get to the overturned requirement in Texas and 27 other states. The federal regulation that was in effect in 08 and 09 that immigrant women and girls were required to get the Gardasil injection in order to come to the U.S. We have 30 seconds. Why was that rule implemented? Why was it changed?
Well, it was probably implemented as a way to lower the incidence of both genital warts as well as cervical cancer, because one of the issues that came up when this vaccine was developed was that it would really help women in the developing world as well to avoid genital wart infections and cervical cancer
but then
at lower rates.
Just so much outrage over having a requirement for immigrants to get injected with something that wasn't being required of Americans?
I think that was probably the issue. I'm not too familiar with the politics involved in that, but I couldn't imagine that wasn't an issue that, you know, you're having sort of dividing populations and having different standards for different people.
And we have to leave it there with Time Magazine health reporter Alice Park. More on the medical science behind the HPV vaccine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.